K-Mud Podcast presents.
The future is Indigenous women.
And there's nothing they can do to top us or drop us, beat us or block us, cause 500 years of genocide couldn't stop this. Look into the dictionary and you'll see the definition of indigenous resilience. This is Native women, my great 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 grandmother's vision. They tried to stamp it out, but the phoenix is risen.
Native women, indigenous women, keepers of the heartbeat, keepers of the rhythm. Native women, indigenous women, from the beginning. Trust your medicine, you were chosen to wake up medicine in the earth. You're the return of your ancestors. Know your power and know your worth.
If you're in Cali with the winds, you always concert with Menominee. If you're a basket weaver, oh, you make that Pueblo pottery. Snohomish or Lenape or Citizen Potawatomi. Illuminate the space with our indigenous. Like cedar smoke, we rise tight like tobacco ties. Like stars in the sky, we are beings of light. With our kin by our side, we walk with love and pride. Changing the world one prayer at a time.
Native women, indigenous women, keepers of the heartbeat, keepers of the rhythm. Native women, indigenous women, we've been right here from the beginning. Trust your medicine, you were chosen to wake up medicine in the earth. You're the return of your ancestors. Know your power and know your worth. Made of earth and the stars above. Ancestral strength inside your blood. A reflection of.
Feel afraid and never feel alone, cause there is lightning in your veins and there is thunder in your bones. The stars shine brighter, the darker the sky. The future is Native women. You were made for these times. So two-spirit women, Afro-Native women, undocumented women, yes, all my Native women, stand firm for the land, stand firm for the children, stand firm for the visions of the world that you're bringing, yeah.
Native women, indigenous women.
To heal. The trauma is not our fault. We've got a higher purpose here.
And that was Lila June and Desiree Harp. Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other Indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes. And again, I opened with Lila June and Desiree Harp, Native Women. Yes, this is March, Women's History Month, so we're going to celebrate it all March. But before I get into today's show, let's talk about the evil that men do. This Netanyahu guy from Israel, what does he have against babies and children? He killed as many as he could in Gaza. And the first thing he bombs in Iran is a girls' school where 148 girls between the ages of 7 and 12 died. And when I say evil that men do, it's because it reminds me of Queen Latifah and her very first album, All Hail the Queen, way back in the 80s. And there's a song on it called The Evil That Men Do. Okay, you can throw Kristi Noem in there, but the evil that men do. But we're going to celebrate Indigenous women, Native women, who are the center of tribal nations. We're the givers of life. You know, we're the center of our present, our past, and our future. And Native women exist. Oh, yeah, they're loud. They're quiet. The ones under the spotlight and the ones doing everything unnoticed. And that is more than enough to celebrate. And there are so many women. We could go, you know, from Ada Deer to Marcella Rose Lebeau to, Lily Gladstone, Deb Haaland, Henrietta Mann. I could go on and on. And we're going to be talking about a lot of them this month. I do want to give a shout out to the Jingle Dancers of Minneapolis. Who did, Ojibwe, all the Ojibwe women who did that jingle dance in ceremony to honor the lives of Renee Good and Alex Peretti. And it was done on a main street, and it got national attention. Yeah, let's talk about the women. But I want to start off by sharing, it's a continuation of a story I did last week about sterilization, but it's a woman I honor today, and that's Julie Francella. She's a Native woman. She is a podcaster. She's a writer. She's been a social worker. She's just, you know, she's an artist, does incredible artwork, an incredible writer. And I'm just so lucky to have found her, or she was brought to my attention by a man. Whenever I read one of her essays, and she always says, share it, share it. So I'm going to share this with you because it's called The Stolen Decision. And she says, forced sterilization is when someone's ability to have children is taken away through surgery without their full, free, and informed consent. For Indigenous women in the United States and Canada, this wasn't a rare mistake or a single bad doctor. It was something done again and again and again through policies, funding, and quiet agreements that targeted our communities. Doctors and officials framed it as family planning or public health, but in practice, it meant Indigenous women being pressured, lied to, or operated on while in labor, sedated, or too scared to say no. While most formal reporting on forced sterilization focuses on the mid-20th century and before, credible evidence and ongoing legal action suggest forced or coerced sterilizations have continued into the 21st century and that the harms are still affecting communities today. In Canada, provincial eugenics laws in places like Alberta and British Columbia explicitly allowed boards to sterilize people they labeled, quote, unfit, and Indigenous women and girls were swept up in those decisions for decades. Even after those laws were repealed, Indigenous women continued to come out of hospital births to discover they'd had tubal ligations they never truly agreed to, or that they were pushed into signing forms while contracting, bleeding, or begging to go home. In some cases, Indigenous women told lawyers they were not permitted to see their newborn babies or even leave the hospital until they agreed to a sterilization procedure. That kind of coercion stripped choice away at one of the most vulnerable moments of their lives. Today, multiple class actions, Saskatchewan, Quebec, and beyond, are built on these stories of women being told, quote, you have enough kids, or, quote, this is what's best, only to learn later that their reproductive future had been taken out of their hands. In the United States, this history is still being formally examined. In 2026, New Mexico launched a state investigation into the forced sterilization of Native American women, seeking to document what happened and how deeply it reshaped communities. Much of that investigation traces back to the 1970s when federal programs like Title X and Indian Health Service practices created conditions where sterilization could be treated as routine. Investigations found that a staggering number of Native women of childbearing age were sterilized over a few short years. and often they were told the surgery was reversible, that it was a routine procedure, or that they would lose their children or benefits if they refused. Some doctors were even paid per operation. Consent forms were waved under their noses during labor or signed when women didn't fully understand the language or the consequences. For readers who are new to this, the key thing to understand is that this is about power, not individual medical decisions. Genocide isn't only mass killing. Under the UN Genocide Convention, one of the acts that can constitute genocide is, quote, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Forced and coerced sterilization does exactly that. It targets the continuation of a people by taking away the ability to have children. This comes out of the same worldview that treated indigenous communities as problems to be managed, poor women as irresponsible, and non-native authorities as the ones who should decide who gets to reproduce. It is part of the same logic that built residential boarding schools, the 60s scoop, and high rates of child apprehension. Fewer indigenous children, fewer indigenous families, fewer indigenous futures. This history also explains why so many indigenous people do not trust the healthcare system. When the same institutions that are supposed to help you heal have for generations cut into indigenous women's bodies without consent, routine care no longer feels routine. A hospital isn't a building with nurses and doctors. It's a place where your auntie was sterilized, where your cousin signed a form she didn't understand, and where your grandmother still refuses to go. That memory sits in the waiting room with you. So when we insist on bringing a relative into the appointment, asking more questions, refusing to sign on the spot, or avoiding certain hospitals altogether, it isn't paranoia. It is survival in a system that has already shown us what it is capable of doing to our bodies and our futures. When Indigenous women speak about what happened, they are often met with doubt, defensiveness, or silence. Quote, that was a long time ago. I'm sure it wasn't like that. But haven't things improved? Each minimizing response adds another layer of harm. The original violation says, your body is not yours. The denial afterward says, your truth isn't real. Recovery requires being believed, being witnessed, and being met with righteous outrage. Instead, many are met with statistics, legal arguments, and polite distance. And at the heart of this is a stolen decision. The choice to have children or not have children is among the most intimate, sacred decisions a person can make. When that choice is removed, a person is forced to live a life bent by someone else's hand. Healing, when it begins, often comes from ceremony, from talking circles, from aunties and grandmothers who listen without flinching. It comes from naming what happened as violence, not miscommunication. It comes from allowing the full grief to move. Rage, sorrow, numbness, envy, tenderness. This pain isn't neat. It doesn't resolve clearly with an apology, compensation, or a news article. It lives in half-finished lullabies, in empty bedrooms that were never painted. In a way, a woman flinches when a doctor casually mentions routine procedures. It also lives in what Indigenous communities do next, insisting on informed consent, on second opinions, on bringing a relative into the room, on refusing to be rushed or shamed. Out of that pain, there's a fierce kind of love, too, a determination that no more of our girls, our women, our two spirits, and trans relatives will be treated as less than sovereign over their own bodies. If you sit with this story, really sit with it. The point is not to drown in horror. It is to understand the depth of what was taken. So when you hear Indigenous women demanding justice, legal, political, spiritual, you understand they are not asking for too much. They're asking for what should have been protected all along. Body sovereignty, truth, and the right to carry our nations forward on our own terms. Martha Redbone, God Created Woman. I'm going to share with you now And, you know, I was looking for a woman at whose story I wanted to share first. And I just, you know, I'm so proud of Jody Potts Joseph that I'm going to share her story. And it's a little long, but it's just wonderful because she wants to encourage young Alaska Natives to travel the way of the ancestors. It's 60 degrees below zero on February 11th in Eagle Village, Alaska. And Jody Potts Joseph is sewing a pair of mukluks for Jesse Holmes, a good friend and co-competitor in the 2026 Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Later, she and her husband, Jamie, will care for the 29 dogs in their kennel. Then she'll spend time on other businesses near and dear to her. The Hungwichtin Village Corporation, of which she is president, and the Doyon Limited, a regional Alaska Native corporation, of which she is a director. And she might talk with the Alaska Wilderness League about the next steps in the fight to save the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and then check in with the program she founded to connect young Indigenous Alaskans to the land through snowboarding. Finally, she might call the North Face Explorer Fund Council and the team working on the film she's producing, Beautiful Resistance. She doesn't sleep much. Quote, "One of the things I tell my family is, I'll rest when I'm dead," said Potts Joseph, who is of the Hans Gitchuan Nation. Quote, "I wish I didn't have to sleep. There's more I want to do." The former star of Nat Geo's Life Below Zero, First Alaskans, is a musher with a mission to bolster interest in mushing among young Indigenous Alaskans and call attention to the environmental changes that are affecting traditional life waves. Potts Joseph is one of 36 mushers competing in this year's Iditarod, a 975-mile race over a steep mountain pass, windswept interior plains, frozen rivers, and the icy Bering Sea coast to Nome. The ceremonial start takes place on March 7th in Anchorage, followed by the official restart in Willow the next day. Mushers and dog teams this year hail from 5 countries and 4 U.S. states. The field is a formidable one. 12 mushers and teams are past top 5 finishers, and 3 of those are past champions. Jesse Holmes of Bruskana, Alaska in 2025, Ryan Reddington of Kinnick, Alaska in 2023, and Thomas Warner of Torpa, Norway in 2020. 3 mushers are Indigenous Alaskans, Kevin Hansen of the Inkwap, Reddington of the same nation, and Potts Joseph. Another, Jesse Terry Ashinabe, is Indigenous from Canada. Mushers and teams have tested their mettle in several races since the 2025 race. Holmes and his team, also familiar to fans of the Nat Geo reality TV show Life Below Zero, are on a winning streak after winning the Iditarod on March 2025. They went on to win a 3rd consecutive Kobuk 440 title the following month. In January, they won their 2nd consecutive Copper Basin 300. Reddington and his team finished 5th in the Kushkokwim 300 in January, and Hansen and Iditarod rookie and his team finished 2nd in the Kobuk 440 in April of 25. Well, Potts Joseph and her dogs proved in 2025 to be a team to watch. They placed 2nd in the Yukon Quest 200, and Potts Joseph won the race's Vet's Choice Award for outstanding dog care on the trail. They also came in 2nd in the 185-mile Percy Day Wolf Memorial Mail Race and 7th in the Kobuk 440. I'm just imagining 185 miles, you know, with your dogs and sled in the snow. All right. Quote, "I have incredible dogs," she said. "They're really awesome, special in their own way, and they all have their strength. They're all bush dogs, and I would say they're pretty tough and pretty happy. We definitely have a really strong bond." The Iditarod begins with a ceremonial start on Saturday, May 7th, with the official start the next day. As she and her team prepare to compete in the race, North America's premier long-distance sled dog race, winning isn't on her radar. To her, this is about cultural preservation. The first peoples of this land traveled with dogs and dog sleds since time immemorial. The dog sled is to Alaska Native cultures what the canoe is to indigenous peoples of the Northwest Coast, and the horse is to indigenous peoples of the plains. Snow machines began replacing sled dogs as the primary mode of transportation in Bush, Alaska in the 1950s, dimming a part of indigenous culture. The late Joe Reddington, who passed in 1999, saw the transition and founded the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race in 1973 to keep the Alaska dog mushing tradition alive. Quote, "It's a big part of it for me. A big part of it for me is helping keep this part of our culture alive, that connection to the land and our ancestors," Potts Joseph told Indian Country Today of mushing with her dog team. Quote, "There are so few native mushers anymore," she said. "It's thriving down in the Yukon Kuskokwim Delta, which is really awesome, but there haven't been any native people running dogs out here in my homelands in decades. Mushing is, I feel like, just so on the verge of being gone altogether." Other indigenous life waves are also under threat as well. Alaska Natives are experiencing rapid lifestyle shifts driven by climate change. Permafrost is thawing and the sea ice is shifting, affecting subsistence fishing, foraging, and hunting. The Yukon River salmon fishery is experiencing a severe multi-year decline, with record low returns of Chinook and fall chum salmon since 2020. A moratorium on fishing for the Yukon River Chinook salmon is in place in Alaska and Canada, creating a food security crisis for indigenous communities who rely on salmon for subsistence and cultural purposes. Quote, "We haven't been able to fish for salmon on the Yukon River for 6 years now," Potts Joseph said, "and we're facing many more years of not fishing." And the salmon is a critical part of the circle of life here. Bears fish for salmon and leave the salmon carcasses on land. Those carcasses are further consumed by wolves, who carry the carcasses to the safety of nearby trees. Nutrients from those salmon remains are absorbed into the soil and tree roots. Plentiful salmon years can be determined by the size of a tree's rings, according to the Rain Coast Conservation Society. And Alaska sled dogs ate and enjoyed the health benefits of salmon, too. The omega-3 fatty acids in salmon made the Alaska sled dog suited for task, travel, and weather in the interior. Good skin and coat health, strong joints, enhanced cognitive function, a bolstered immune system, and heart health. Quote, "We fed salmon to our dogs when I was growing up," Potts Joseph said. Quote, "We didn't need to buy kibble. It was a very sustainable way of living on the land and a sustainable way of transportation. It's a lot harder, especially on the Yukon River, to maintain a dog team without the salmon." Alaska Native mushers and their teams traverse ancestral routes in the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, often accompanied by the Northern Lights dancing in the night sky. The Northern Lights have a spiritual significance to Alaska Native people. Quote, "I think a lot of my grandpa because I'm mushing on trails that my ancestors established and set up thousands of years ago," Jody Pott said. Quote, "My husband and I have reopened a lot of old trails that my grandpa put back in the mountains for his trap line. That is really special. So yes, it is a lot about cultural preservation. All of us Native people hold a lot of pride in who we are, and we're still here." Pot Joseph's dogs will make a culturally splendorous start and finish at the race. They'll wear beaded dog blankets made by Native women from Alaska, Canada, and the lower 48 in a response to a call-out Potts Joseph made on social media a month and a half ago. quote, our people, when we had big village gatherings before a family arrived from a trap line or from another village for a community gathering, they would put their best gear on themselves and their dogs, she said. And so I'm really excited that my dogs will wear these beautiful beaded dog blankets for the start and the finish of the race. Residents of Alaska Native communities turn out at all hours to celebrate the arrival of mushers and dog teams at checkpoints along the route. It's often a time of reunion for mushers, friends, and relatives, a time when elders pass on knowledge. Quote, from my first Iditarod to my last, it was always so good to go to all of the different villages, said Yupit Chief Mike Williams Sr., a veteran of 15 of those races and a two-time recipient of the event's most inspirational Musher Award. People in the Athabascan villages were excited and happy when I arrived, and I got to Ruby in the Yukon. I felt like I was home. I think that's how Jody is going to feel. They're going to appreciate her and cheer for her. Those are going to be very happy towns. And depending on the year, mushers may pass through Hulsea, which is the home of George Atla Jr., the Athabascan musher known as the Hulsea Hustler. Or they may pass through Ruby, home of Emmett Peters, the Athabascan musher known as the Yukon Fox, who won this 1975 race and had five more top five finishes. Quote, I think mushing instills a lot of pride in our people, Potts Joseph said. In our community, so many people share their stories with me. I can see this little sparkle in people's eyes when they talk about growing up with dogs and old Indian tricks about mushing and dogs. There's still a lot of great traditional knowledge out there, and I love connecting with elders. They give me advice and tips and pointers, and I really appreciate that. I love the conversations in the village. Alaska Native culture is reflected in some of the special awards that are given during the race. The first musher into McGrath, which is mile 311, receives beaver fur musher's mitts with Athabascan beadwork on moose hide, handcrafted by Loretta Melel, and a beaver fur hat made by Rosalie Igras. And they are both Athabascan. And the first musher into Caltag, which is mile 714, receives a check for $2,000 and 25 pounds of salmon from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Alaska is an unpredictable in its breathtaking beauty. Alaska comprises 665,384 square miles. That's roughly 17.5% of the total U.S. landmass, with cold desert tundra, vast boreal forest, and wetlands, temperate coastal forest, and rugged mountain terrain. Mushers often expect the unexpected, and the land deserves respect. The land deserves respect, Pot Joseph said. You just have to know there's going to be a lot of things that are out of your control and that you've got to try to make smart decisions. And sometimes you end up making all the right decisions and you still end up in a freak storm. She added, I'm an interior Athabascan through and through, and this is my country. I know this land, but once I get out to the coast, I feel like I'm in a much different place, in a foreign land, so I definitely have a great deal of respect for those places. And you know, you just can't let fear control you. I have to go out there and just take what comes and then do the best I can for my dogs. A day, you know, And that was Elisa Pai, and she is a Inuktitut nation, and I can't begin to pronounce the name of the song, but it translates to "born to be alive." And indeed, Jodi Potts was born to be alive. Everything that she does is just incredible, and I'm really excited for her in that race. I want to share with you now a poem called "Growing Up in Pueblo," "Growing Up Pueblo and White in America," and it's from Soma Toya Holland from Laguna Pueblo, and she says, and this is the poem: "Growing up Pueblo and white means my privilege shifts in each space I occupy. My code switch is always on for emotional safety. I can simultaneously be both the oppressed and the oppressor. Means my relatives are cowboys and Indians, and both and neither. Means I'm still subject to the American project of assimilation. It has only been three generations since my ancestors were taken to St. Catharines as children. I grew up thinking this was a normal part of our history until Intro into Native American Studies sophomore year, I learned how lucky I was that they came home from that school at all. Means I grew up despising the shape of my chin, my cheeks, my dimples. But when my grandmother left Earthside, I began to see her in my own reflection. My features have always been Pueblo. The only reason I thought I didn't want them was because white supremacy told me they were unattractive. Means I have been to more funerals than most of my non-native friends, and I have to listen to them say they relate when they will never fully understand. I'm not just grieving my relatives, but every single bit of knowledge lost when so much has already been stolen. When I go to visit their resting places, tribal police stop to ask me if I'm a member. I have to say no, but I grew up in that trailer with the red porch right across the way. I am Mary Toya's grandchild. I promise that I belong here, even though I don't have a card to prove it. I promise that I belong here, even though I don't have a card to prove it. Means I can tell a white person that I am Native, and they will respond with some racist straight to my face because, in their mind, they have already killed an Indian and saved nothing. They only see the parts of me that they can understand. When someone tells me that I am the first Native person they have met in the same sentence as, "But you couldn't play Native on TV," the only response I can muster is, "I know." I overexplain, put a disclaimer on my existence when I'll never be in control of how I am perceived anyway. There is this recurring sharpness in my gut, familiar since a white man came to my Albuquerque preschool to teach us about the Pueblos like I wasn't still living at one just 40 miles away. He had brought a little manta, probably the same size as the one I had at home, and let a blonde girl in my class try it on like a costume. A piercing twinge, the urge to raise my hand, to stand up and say something, to break out of the seemingly invisible box that I'm stuck in and shout, "I'm right here! We still exist!" But that sharpness is echoed by the ringing in my chest, the racing heart every time I hope to be seen with relatives I haven't met yet. When I sat down to write about growing up Native in America, I thought, am I Native enough to take up space on these pages? I have never known how much energy to occupy in the rooms full of people who I relate to the most. At an ACES AISES conference in high school, I introduced myself to a room full of kids, and I said I was from Laguna. One came to find me after. He said something to me in Querez, just to see if I knew how to respond. Quote, "At least she can speak," he said. I know what I look like to people who don't know me, so I was proud that I passed his test. When I go to Jimenez to dance, I am always ready to explain who I am, who my family is, and that I grew up mostly at Laguna, so I don't speak Toa, and I'm sorry that I don't understand everything, but I am listening. I know that I will be recognized if I continue to show up. When I was little, my family always called me Wooly because I'm the only one with thick, wavy brown hair, a trait which must have come from the same person whose name is absent from my birth certificate. But one thing about being Native is we often carry many names. And my name translates to get close, and I am Turquoise Clan. I wonder if I was given this name so I would remember to examine things a little more carefully, to invite a shift in perspective. I am either Kawakame or I am not. So why did I grow up constantly being made to measure my belonging? I know this much is true. Being Pueblo means the only currencies that have any value to me are love and reciprocity. Being Pueblo means I know how to belly laugh in the thick of mourning because the rest of us are still here together. Being Pueblo means my love for the earth is not a trend or a choice, but a practice, an obligation that I have inherited from beyond more generations than I can count. I'm still learning which parts of my judgment have not been blighted by whiteness, by the standard I'm held to in every space that doesn't fully see me. It is sometimes tricky finding balance on this tightrope of privilege, but I have plenty of friends, sibling, aunties, kin to help me up when I lose it. We grow up playing in the dirt, running from rattlesnakes, climbing rocks and skinning knees, so I am not afraid of falling. Being native in America is more than a blood quantum. It is a state of mind, and I've never met a res dog who wasn't mixed.
The smell of burning cedar is foreign, but somehow familiar. I don't want this honor. I don't deserve it. My pale skin and urban blossoming leaves me uprooted. I wish I could speak my native language, style my hair traditionally, swirl gracefully in fancy shawl. But I know I am the family's exception. Natanaba, the people who come back from war. I don't live up to this name. My face burns, my eyes itch, and my legs tingle when he beckons me towards him. Clara, Shiyash, Grandpa says. It is time. We are thirsty. My eyes dash around the circle for Grandma. The fire flickers between us, and shadows cast upon the elders' wrinkled faces. She stands, motions to the entrance with her lips. I rise slowly. We wrap the blankets over my shoulders. Right foot first, we step out of the teepee, and the door closes. Outside, my cowhide moccasins melt the snow. Morning stars shake soft glitter upon the apples of my cheeks. My eyes glaze over skeletal trees and snow shimmering on tall teepee poles. I see her. Grandma. Snow falls gently on her pepper-gray hair before dissolving. She hands me the morning water. In that moment, I become a young woman, the new water maiden. I take on all the responsibilities as many before me have done. We re-enter the teepee. I kneel before a bucket painted with symbolic designs. The water reflects the flames. My tongue moistens coarse edges of dried corn husk that I fill with tobacco. Good, Shiyash. Grandmother hands me the lighting stick to start a smoke. My hands shake. Tobacco trickles from the husk as I raise it to my lips and inhale. Taste buds dance with bitter smoke. I begin my prayer. Blessing all who have contributed to my upbringing, I blow to all four directions, to the sky, to our Mother Earth, and onto my hands and bless myself. Sparks coil out of the teepee's opening and mix into orange clouds. Morning has come. It is time. The thirst, so tempting, my coarse throat knotted and aching, but generosity compels me to pass the bucket to others first. Each person dips and drinks. Beads of water stroll down their chins, then are rubbed through their hair. The water combines all of us. Now that we have quenched our thirst, we pray with one gourd, sing with one voice, flow with one blood, and love with the same ancient heart. Hajon Hasli, Hajon Hasli, Hajon Hasli, Hajon Hasli.
And that was Clara Natonaba, and from the Dene Nation, The Thirst. From a great CD that I have, Moccasins and Microphones, Modern Native Storytelling through Performance Poetry, and it's all high schoolers. I'm going to share this with you. Both these poems and stories that I'm reading, it's my life growing up Native in America. And this is from Ceci Meadows, and she is Sokana and Yome Nation. And she says, it's called The Ag Worker's Daughter. Fresh strawberries, crispy lettuce, humongous artichokes, tasty broccolini, picked and boxed by the hands of our mothers, fathers, grandparents, tias, and tios. Working in the hot, scorching sun, picking your food for pennies on the dollar, trying to hit that daily quota or they won't get paid. Eating and rehydrating, resting for just a moment will cost them the day. Zacanos, indigenous people called cheap laborers and igales, working the lands of our ancestors on farms that once belonged to us. Don't they get tired of making up names for us? We are the never-respected people who work hard to provide for their families, only innocents whom they rob and mistreat, disposable bodies who endure the deadly heat and the violent rays, stolen bracheros who return to our homelands in Mexico, empty-handed, robbed, and owed millions. Raising and protecting my youngest siblings, trying to shield them from the bullets flying through our windows. Mis papas missing special occasions, school events, championships, and awards assemblies. La corrida keeps them enslaved for dreams of our better opportunities. It never made me mad. Just sad they never got to see me accept awards and achieve accolades I dedicated to them each and every time. The golden child, they call me, the one who makes it out, the interpreter, the educated one, the loud mouth screaming for justica, fairness, and land back. I've worn the fancy black business suits, sat in their corporate boardrooms, learning their lingo and the truth of how they built generational wealth, and this country on the backs of my ancestors. So I walk in my destiny on the prayers and the orgullo de mi familia, soaking up knowledge, creating connections with allies, and bonding with like-minded friends who become relatives, hustlers, hard workers, never waiting for things to be handed to us, rooted in culture, música, danza y ceremonia. Somos semillas, the ample harvest, a blessing of a new sunrise, the most beautiful flowers that bloom. I am proudly the ag worker's daughter. And I wanted to share that because there are so many beautiful indigenous women whose mothers and aunties and families have been growing the food we eat for generations now, all because they want their children to do better, to get an education. And this year, they've been treated worse than, less than human. Let's put it that way, less than human. Being rounded up, put in detention camps, sent to countries they've never been to. Hard, hard-working people. And what's going to happen? What's going to happen to that food that's not going to get picked this year? I guess when people, that white supremacy people, when they're eating, they don't remember the color of the skin of the person who grew it for them. Because there's not many Anglos in this country working out in those fields. The only Anglo farmers are the organic home farmers, the people that have gardens in their backyards. but the food for the masses? What's going to happen? What is going to happen? I'm going to close with Lyda Downs. She is from Mexico. And honor women.
This has been a K-Mutt podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.